Richard next.
Hi, yeah, I don't want to, I mean, I agree with pretty much everything that's been said already, but I just wanted to add that I did actually once muck out a sump full of feces. I was actually working on a project, so it got complicated, but anyway, the system by which the sewage was actually pumped out of the sump stopped working, and we had to actually get it out manually. And it was full of stinking, horrible work. But the fact is, we got together, there were about six of us, and it was a lot of fun. Because when you get together and you do things collectively for a collective purpose, as kind of vile and horrible as the job may be, you can make it a lot less vile and horrible just because it has to be done. You do what needs to be done, and you do it collectively, you do it together. And I think, you know, so it doesn't matter how horrible the jobs can be. If you can do it, knowing that you are doing it for a collective purpose and that you're doing it in ways that you minimize the unpleasantness to yourself, there's no reason why people won't continue to do that in socialism. But the only other thing I would add with Paddy, you mentioned that a party member once gave an interesting answer to this question. I also had an interesting answer to this question once, and somebody was saying the usual thing, who's going to do the dirty work? And the answer was the kids, send the kids down, they'll just love it. Not being terribly serious there, but, you know, if you want a pat answer, it's a good one. Thanks.
It's probably true. I can remember being a kid playing in piles of mud and getting absolutely covered in mud as a kid.
My folks thought I was going to be a hydraulic engineer because I was always pumping the water out of drains into farmers' farmyards and their chicken coops. But anyway, that's another story. Thanks.
So I think when. Why people ask this dirty work question is, of course, dirty work is associated with cheap labour and, undervalued labour. So it's more about what work would be regarded as important rather than whether it's clean or dirty, I would have thought. Mike Foster.
Cheers. Thoughts popped into my head since I last put a queue in. Yeah, I think something that's behind this question and also behind the question about the earlier one about people who refuse to work. And I think it also is one way of interpreting the next question as well, is the assumption that in order to motivate people to do dirty work, it needs, you know, the assumption there is that dirty work is inherently nasty. And therefore people need to be compelled to do it. And, you know, with obviously, you know, financial incentive is the way of is the way it's done in capitalism. So I think that's sort of lurking behind a couple of questions in this sort of section of the list. So and of course, you know, the reply to that one is that if you change the nature of labour, then it undercuts this question as has already been described. And I think as well the capitalist assumption that to do dirty work people need to be compelled to do it, that takes quite a dim view of human potential and human motivation as well. And again, obviously that leads back to capitalism creating a dim view of people. But yeah, I suppose my point was that that there's the question of motivation to work is sort of behind this question. That's something else that we need to be ready to address as well if someone asks about it. Yeah, cheers, Tom.
Okay, thank you, Mike. I don't know if you're actually psychic, Mike, but those present will be interested to know that I haven't put up the details yet, but we'll be having a talk in February on why people would be motivated to work in socialism. So keep an eye on the events calendar for the date for that talk. Steve, I presume you didn't want to say anything about Rousseau, or did you want to say something about Rousseau? I'm not quite sure what you meant.
Yeah, sorry, it's just that that's Emile on education. I think he put that idea forward in the 18th century.
What idea?
Thank you, Pan. About kids doing the dirty work because they love it.
Oh, okay, right. We see.
It's got a long history. And by the way, just talking about long history, so-called brilliant arguments against socialism. This is basically human nature: is that we're lazy, we're greedy, and we're aggressive. All these things that have been fostered by Christianity, Judaism, Islam, I suppose, as well. So they're all of a like, all of the same.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, Steve. I always tend to think of these as sort of variations of the original sin proposition, which is still very much alive and kicking in secular capitalism, of course. Freddie, next.
Yeah, thanks. It's just to supplement what I said earlier in terms of what maybe regarded as got to work. I mean, I don't know many comrades or people whom get engaged in voluntary work at the weekend. For example, cleaning out ditches in forests or in woodlands, etc., in order to improve the habitat, etc. You know, being up to your knees in waders or Wellingtons or whatever. There's thousands of people every weekend engaged in voluntary work, which some of it could be rather unpleasant. And they're doing that without any pay. So I think that this is just to supplement what I said previously. Dirty work does get done because people are conscious enough to understand that in order to try and improve what we have, we need to work at it to do it.
Okay, thanks, Freddie. That's very true, actually. We don't really talk about what volunteers do, and yet volunteers do a huge amount of work in capitalism, an absolutely massive amount. They're one of the world's biggest industries, if you can call them an industry. And also, of course, we didn't mention dangerous work. You look at the work of lifeboat crews and mountain rescue and things like that. These people go out and risk their lives for free. So yeah, that's another point worth making. Okay, so time to go on to the next question. Oh, I think so. I think so. This question is a tricky one. How efficient would socialism be? Would surgeons perform operations when needed? Would the trains run on time? Or would they run at all? Okay, who wants to have a go at that one? And John's up first.
I think what we would be concerned about more than efficiency would be effectiveness. Efficiency is really a term that tends to be used and overused within capitalism, and their notion of efficiency is all to do with economics, whereas our notion of what would be effective rather than efficient would be that needs would be satisfied as and when they're required. So I don't think efficiency would have the same importance attached to it. It would be more... It would revert back to being a scientific term in terms of the use of energy and stuff like that, I think, more than anything else.
Taking on the subject of surgeons, would surgeons perform operations when needed? But surgeons don't operate on their own. They're part of a vast healthcare infrastructure. They can't operate if they don't have the equipment or the tools or the clothing and all the rest of it. They can't operate without ancillary staff, Ancillary staff can't operate without a hospital being maintained, and that can't operate without regular supply and energy and things like that. And this all feeds into a general social infrastructure, all of which has to be maintained on a permanent basis in order for the surgeon to go and do their job on a particular day on a particular patient. So I think efficiency is a relevant question. Taking the question of the trains, would anybody care to suggest that I live up north, supposing I want to go and visit somebody in London, can I get a train once an hour, once a day, once a week? What does anybody think? Brian?
Yes. a lot of presumption under this question is, but there again. In regards to trains, I mean, the one in regards to surgeons and all the rest of it has been answered, right? Would the trains run on time? The presumption here is that social society, like capitalist society, will depend a lot on the clock. It would depend on pace and, in fact, on where and where needed, or even where it's not needed, quickly up the pace. In other words, speed things up, etc., etc. You know, what you need to remember is that the trains don't or won't need to run on time. They need to run like anything else. But whether they run on time will depend on how many passengers they're carrying, and where they're going, etc., etc. And that will depend on the rest of the community. You know, they will have to decide how the trains go.
Well, let's just explore this a little bit more.
Sorry, just need to apologise there. That last bit there was a bit weak.
Let's supposing that for various reasons we don't need to go into, I volunteered to work at a plant or production facility, say 20 miles away, 30 miles away, something like that. And I need to get the train, and I need to get the train for a particular time because the other people there are relying on a change of shift and that sort of thing. And I get to the train station and they say, oh, well, sorry, we don't have a timetable. We just depart when full. That's not really going to work, is it? Anybody? I'm ignoring people. We've got Freddie in the queue.
I think that's the old question, but I could make a contribution to this in terms of if we're looking at, you know, how efficient, etc., society will determine that need at the time as to whether or not we need to run one carriage, two carriages, three carriages, and the frequency of it. And to some extent, I would imagine the same people that are controlling the trains in the sense of making timetables and how many carriages are used, the planners, etc., be pretty much involved in that as well. They will determine it as what needs must be. And so, you know, the precise question that I think I'm more to answer is society will determine at the time as to what the needs are to move from A to B, whether that be people or products.
Okay. Remind you that if we were being asked this question on TV, people's conception of trains running on time, I mean, this is a sort of, you know, this is famously how Mussolini was described. You know, he might be a bastard, but at least he made the trains run on time. People perceive that as important. They perceive efficiency as important. If we come across as, you know, incredibly lackadaisical of saying, oh, well, you know, people will just sort out whatever suits them, I don't think that's going to go down very well. John Cumming, I think, if I've got the right place.
I think it's strangely enough, I think in socialism, there'd be a better chance of the trains working on time than there was in capitalism, partly because a lot of the useless movements will have been eliminated, and only such movements as are more conducive to human happiness will be taking place. So I think, strangely enough, it may well be that a side effect of a socialist society may well be that things that hadn't hitherto run in time will tend to work pretty much to the timetable. But what others have said about timetables being adapted to the needs of society, that's really true. We have to just think of a way to express that succinctly, I suppose.
I think you've got a good point there, John, actually. It just occurred to me, just going back to the trains thing a minute, we've probably all heard about the fact that the train system, because they've cut costs so many, they don't have enough drivers. So frequently they're taxiing train drivers down from Glasgow to London to drive the Glasgow train and taxiing them back again. So, I mean, you know, even in capitalism, you know, efficiency is not a foregone conclusion at all. Dougie?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a niece that works at Piccadilly Railway Station, and, you know, trying to work out the trains. And I think trains would have to run on time in socialism. I mean, the way trains operate, you get slow trains and fast trains. You get trains that stop more and others that go maybe to two or three stops on the way to London from Glasgow. So, I mean, you can't have people just deciding to drive the train at any time when it's full or something. It would just cause accidents, you know. I mean, you'd have to have trains running on time, really, you know. And, I suppose if there's not a demand for trains to stop at a certain stop, you can do it by saying you've got to tell the guard you want to stop at that stop so you can get off or whatever. Otherwise, the train could continue on. But, I mean, I think the trains would have to run on time, right? It's just like buses and things like that. I mean, yeah, you have to do that, really, especially for safety purposes.
Okay, Howard's telling us that Mussolini didn't make the trains run on time. It's a myth. It probably is a myth. I can imagine how that myth started, the idea of an authoritarian regime. Whatever else they achieved, they must have at least managed that, but probably didn't. Anyone who's been in the Italian train network find it hard to believe that even Mussolini could do that. Mike Foster next.
Yeah, I don't know if it's another myth, but I remember hearing that sort of times were only standardised across Britain once trains came in and you know, timetables were needed, and before, you know, trains were around, you know, sort of time was very much more localised. So, you know, there might be a couple of hours difference between different areas, but yeah, anyway, that was beside the point. I think another way of answering this question would be to point out that a socialist society, people would be much more free to choose what kind of labour they would do. So those who prefer a more structured working life would sort of gravitate to work which needed that kind of structure, including a structure of, you know, set times for shifts to be done or set times for appointments. And other people who didn't want to or weren't inclined to work in that way would be able to find a more laid back role to play, which doesn't require, you know, sort of turning up at certain times each day. And again, you know, certain communities would be more structured and sort of place a greater importance on time, and other communities might function without that same structure. So again, yeah, I think the freedom of choice of where you of how you work and what you do, which you'd have much more of in socialism. That could be another way to answer this question alongside the ways that have already been suggested. Yeah, cheers.
Oh, thanks for that, Mike. That's a really good point, actually. And nobody challenged me on my proposition that I was an essential worker at a factory 30 miles away on the question, well, why didn't I just move closer to it then? And the other thing you said was also interesting is that it reminds me that I remember reading, I think it was in the war commentaries, someone can correct me, that the clocks only started appearing on church steeples and pocket watches appeared during the early Industrial Revolution. So for the first time, people actually needed to know the exact time as opposed to just looking at the sun. Mike Brown.
Yeah, there's two questions here. There's how efficient would socialist society be? Well, I would say it would be highly efficient. It'd be highly efficient use of the Earth's resources, because most of the waste that's involved would be lost. It wouldn't do it. I remember sitting on a picket line in Lancaster for about an hour and a half, looking at the traffic. I had noticed, I counted all the cars in that hour. 70% of them were one person in them. Each one, that one person, had a load of energy usage. All that wasted energy usage that the armed forces do, that most of the companies do, would be used anymore. So it would be highly efficient. I would go on to how efficient society would be in the use of energy in this question. Or would search and, come on, start an operation, all that. Well, have you ever been to a doctor? does he say, piss off, or whatever? He says, what's the matter with you? It's a he. She says, what's the matter with you? It's a she. I mean, it's a non-starter, that one. There's too many people working to help other people. You get a buzz from it when you help people. That's the question about the strange one on time. I just leave and say, well, what the fuck do you need them for? I wouldn't say it like that, but you know what I mean.
Okay, yeah. So this is the more aggressive response, which is, what do you mean less efficient? It'd be more efficient. Capitalism is not efficient at all. I think that's probably the right way to address this question, actually, is to attack the efficiency of capitalism rather than try and defend the efficiency of socialism. That seems like the right approach. Steve?
Efficiency, Paddy.
Okay, Steve?
All right, yes. Yeah, sorry, I thought Mike wanted to come back. Yeah, unfortunately, it's going to be a repeat of what's more or less what I said earlier. A question like this is, assuming that the only reason that trains can run on time is because there's some sort of market behind it. I think that's what anybody that's asking be trying to get at. Well, that's an absolute load of nonsense, because we do not need the market for us to act in a rational manner, which includes getting the trains to run on time, which includes getting surgeons into surgeries with all the ancillary support required. So yeah, so certainly we need to attack the questioner's basis. Okay, that's.
Okay, thank you. And Nick, next.
I just wonder whether I could pose a question, because you seem to have posed a hell of a lot of questions, Paddy. A quote from Henry Kissinger. He said, Margaret Thatcher was a perfect example of success, taking all the choices offered to her. How would people respond to that?
That a compliment from Henry Kissinger is hugely to be avoided, I would have thought. Anybody else?
I think you might need to explain what you mean.
Yeah, I think you might need to explain that.
I was just going to ask.
Marx's response to that was the choices, I can't remember the exact quote, but the choices you make depend on your circumstances. Margaret Thatcher had a lot better choices than most of us, or most of the rest of the population. And that's why she was so successful. That was the point.
Oh, you mean personal life choices as opposed to political choices. Right, I think I'm with you. Okay. I think we've got John next.
I think the phenomenon that was Margaret Thatcher is needs probably quite a lot of explaining. Notwithstanding the fact that she did well for herself, it does help if you marry a millionaire or join a political party that's dedicated to self-advancement within capitalism. And it is true that the woman did work very, very hard. She seemed to lead a very joyless existence for most of her life, being worried about perhaps the people that didn't pay their tick in her father's shop. Maybe that preyed on her mind all these years later. But it does help if you're in the right circumstances to take advantage of the various so-called opportunities, which is the buzzword today.
Okay, thanks, John. Yeah, if Margaret Thatcher led a joyless life, she seemed determined to make everybody else lead one too. So maybe it's time to move on to the next question then, which is, hasn't history proved people are just innately aggressive? Hasn't history proved that humans are just innately aggressive? And I think it's Steve up first.
Yeah, just something to make people... This of course is something faced, but there is a new study brought out very recently called "The Survival of the Friendliest." One of the authors is a bloke called Brian Hare, Hare. You can get it on. You can get this online, because somebody downloaded it for me. I think it was a link, wasn't it?
So what they've done is, rather than the naked ape study of the 1960s, which was Morris, I've forgotten his first name. This is a study of bonobo chimps, which reveals an extremely interesting things about human nature or primate nature. So is it worth socialist? I've not had a chance to read it yet. I'm going to read it in the next 3 months.
Okay, thank you. And Nick's next.
Capitalism has been the principal cause of wars, hierarchy, domination and aggression, and all the aggression that goes with it. None of this, you know, would happen in a socialist society.
Right, okay. Well, I don't think any of us particularly disagree with that, Nick. It's just that how would we be able to persuade an interviewer of that? Mike next.
Yes, it's history. I would say, what history are you relying on? Because the history of class societies show that people have, the ruling class have a propensity to use violence. The history of human societies, what we know of them, and we're still learning about them, doesn't show that. It's only since class societies, use of weapons in Southeast Europe, for example, little is known about that. Most of the history of the humans on the earth, they've cooperated, been aggressive. The only way to get on against the struggle of getting food, clothing, shelter from nature's resources. But the history of class societies, which I think they're meaning this, the recorded history from about 2,000 years ago, or probably from the Greeks when they started writing, that shows a lot of aggression, but that's class society. It's not capitalist society, it's class society.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I think it's probably a good idea to make a distinction between history and prehistory, of course. Next, Jen and Tony.
Well, they were there, now they've gone. Oh, no.
Jane and Tony?
I'm unmuted now. So, I mean, I remember reading stuff about Papua New Guinea and the sort of vicious wars they had between fairly small tribes that didn't seem to be particularly hierarchical, and it seemed to be about resources. And I remember the sort of famous story about the chimpanzees slaughtering each other, and it was about resources. It's about scarcity. So I think we should be careful about making some sort of blanket statement about people aren't aggressive. People try and survive, and I think the sort of the problem with the sort of people don't have any sort of inherent aggression is, where did it come from, really? I mean, people are just naturally friendly and chummy and all the rest of it. Then where the fuck did aggression come from? Where did class society come from? And scarcity has to be the key to it, I would have thought. Anyway, that's me.
Okay, thanks. Mike Foster next.
I was going to make the same point that Tony just made, really. Yeah, that aggression in terms of violent crime, muggings or attacks against other people, sort of local personal ones rather than sort of wider scale wars. Yeah, that can often be traced down to deprivation. As Tony said, the word he used was scarcity. That leads to people to go out and mug people or what have you. So again, it's a similar point that societal conditions shape traits like aggression, and a socialist society wouldn't have the scarcity or deprivation, and therefore it would undermine the reasons behind a lot of aggression. It can't be ruled out, of course. It's part of being human. It just depends how it's channeled. But yeah, that was my point. Yeah, same as one Tony made, really. Cheers.
Okay, thank you. It just occurred to me, actually, that one possible tactic with this question is to turn it round on the interviewer and say to the interviewer, tell me this, do you believe there's such a thing as a gene for aggression? Just because I think that sometimes we sound a bit defensive in the way that we're defending socialism, whereas, you know, I think sometimes the tactic might be better to attack the assumptions of the interviewer. Okay, John Cummings next.
Yes, I think the question about is there a gene for aggression is a particularly good one, because there's not a gene for any single one thing usually, unless it's a very, very simple trait indeed. But I think a case could be made to say that human beings are not innately anything, really. We perhaps have innate capacities for a whole variety of behaviours. As for the question of aggression, I think it's perhaps the case that most people are not inclined to be aggressive, and that perhaps partly explains the success of people who later went on to become the feudal landowners, who tended to dominate the countryside by going around beating people up, beating up their cattle, and then retreating to their castles, where they would be safe from any retaliation, and that allowed them to consolidate their power. And similarly with capitalism, it's much more civilised, as they say, but of course it has its brutal forms of coercion as well. So I think rather than the majority of people being aggressive, perhaps they're not aggressive enough.
Okay, thank you, John. Howard's up next.
When this topic first started to be seriously discussed in recent times, in the 60s and 70s, a good number of books were published which argued the idea that human nature was naturally aggressive, hostile. Books of the kind that Steve mentioned, like Desmond Morris's book, The Naked Ape, various others, books by, for example, Robert Ardrey, Conrad Lorenz, spring to mind as well. And despite what the party was saying at the time, that was the sort of seemed to be the sort of widespread view. Well, the pendulum has very much swung the other way more recently. In the last decade or so, there's been a sort of slew of books which have argued on the basis of very effective research, just the opposite, that human beings have the potential at least to be, and in correct circumstances, in the right circumstances, would be friendly, cooperative, anything but inimical and hostile to one another. Just to sort of, throw out a couple of titles. There's one was written in 2019 called Team Human. You know, the title itself tells a story. And there's one which is going to be reviewed soon, I hope, in the Socialist Standard, a very important book called Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman, a Dutch writer who also wrote a book several years ago, sort of saying something very similar, but coming from somewhere else, called Utopia for Realists. So there we are, just to say that the pendulum has swung now in the direction, in our direction, so to speak.
Okay, thanks, Howard. I think that, I think he mentioned earlier that this these questions might want to be updated. And this one, I just wonder if that's an example of something that's maybe a bit out of date. How many people really believe that humans are innately aggressive nowadays, I wonder? Okay, so Richard's next.
Well, unfortunately, I probably have to take, a very different view on this. An awful lot of people think human beings are innately aggressive. And for every positive book that you actually can name, there's one on the other side coming out now. I mean, in academia, there's an ongoing huge debate. I mean, of course there is. There's a huge debate about this because the issue is so fundamentally political. So you have people on both sides. I mean, you have people like Richard Wrangham and Steven Pinker on the sort of on the side where human beings are sort of naturally aggressive and stuff. So you actually do still have this fight, still is going on, and it's still a live issue. At least not just in Tamia, but as far as I can see when I actually debate people online. But I think, and I think it's a hard one, and the reason it's going on, it's a hard one to bottom out, because you know, you get people like Steven Pinker in his, like his books like The Blank Slate and The Better Angels of Our Nature, and he has been completely slaughtered by anthropologists, showing just how poor quality his scholarship is. And certainly when talking about older traditions of, you know, sort of historical and prehistorical forms of social organization, he's simply full of cherry picking and double counting and everything in order to try and make his claim that in fact it needs a strong state to kind of suppress human natural aggression. You know, so, you know, there is these, it's so difficult to, because the arguments are getting so complex and depends an awful lot of actual knowledge of, you know, sort of the academic disciplines that actually research this stuff, that it's actually very hard to kind of argue from a factual point of view. I mean, I think all we can do is to point out that there is obviously no fundamental issue with something, some peculiar thing called human nature, which is usually very ill-defined, that will commit us to being aggressive. Human aggression exists in all societies, every single society we have known, but it takes different forms in different societies. And for example, as usual to sort of hunter-gatherer societies, certain kinds of hunter-gatherer societies only have aggression in the form of like immediate one-to-one or small group aggression. And that's because they live in societies where there is no fixed hierarchy and no one can stand in between anyone else and the satisfaction of their needs. So hierarchies can't develop. This is where you start getting hierarchy, aggression. Immediately state societies and private property, the evidence of aggression just goes up exponentially. That is something that we can say with certainty. But, you know, we don't know whether the reason why it was so unusual in societies or even modern societies which have which are without property and hierarchy, we don't know whether that might just be because their numbers were few. So, you know, this can always be argued back and forth. But what we can say, as I said, is that we do know that there is nothing inherent in human beings which actually ensures that societies will be aggressive, because if that were the case, then all societies would be aggressive. And we do know of societies that are actually not aggressive. So I would always rest on that point as a sort of ultimate answer to this question, because I think it's the only ground that I know of that we can genuinely stand on.
Okay, thanks. And Howard next. Sorry, Steve next.
Yeah, just very interesting what Rachel said. Of course, what one thing that we could add to is the fact that if human beings are so aggressive, how on earth did we ever cooperate enough to come up with this wonderful thing called language? But anyway, just so that's one minor point. But just to come back to, I mentioned this thing, the survival of the friendly. This isn't to say that one of the arguments apparently is the fact that there is a difference between bonobo behaviour and other chimp behaviour, precisely because they don't have a scarcity in their immediate environment. Apparently, they've got an abundance of food in their environment, and there is no pressure on them. So this is not to say there's anything innately wonderful about primates, but that once you've got scarcity, then aggression is likely to occur. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Howard next.
Just to say that I agree with what Richard said, that the battle is actually still being fought over this. But what I said was meant to be my brief, simplistic answer to Andrew Neil, which is the kind of thing we're trying to do in these sessions, I think.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. And Richard's not wanting to speak. Okay. Yeah, just it just reminds me that going back to what Steve said about the bonobos and the chimps, they're separated by the Congo River, which is a rift valley, I think, and well, it's very deep anyway. And yeah, they both live in very different circumstances. The bonobos have a fairly easy time of it, and the chimps don't. Mike Brown, I think, next.
Yeah, thanks, Paddy. I was listening to Hodner, and I was amazed that all these books that have come out since, I think it was The Naked Ape or something like that. I remember the earliest movie I can remember, this was 2001, where you got a load of, it looked like men dressed in monkey suits, and they were mumbling together, and somebody picks up some sort of old bone and throws in the air and smacks people with it. That's where the myth started. But I don't believe any of these things. If humans were innately aggressive, how on earth would a woman give birth to a child and raise it without doing it? Answer me that.
I can't really, Mike, because I didn't understand it, because you kept breaking up a lot.
Okay, I'll say it again. If humans were innately aggressive, I would assume that would apply to women as well as men, because they're humans, you see. How on earth does a woman give birth to a child and raise it without killing it?
Okay, all right. Well, chimps manage to do that, of course, don't they? All right, so Freddie's next.
Yeah, I'm not looking at this from the perspective of what academics have written, as valued as some of them may be. I look at this from the perspective of the world in which I'm actually living and life's experience itself. And I haven't found people to be innately aggressive overall. Yes, you'll get your occasional fight from the pub at night or whatever it may be. But when we're talking about aggression, we're talking about this in the concept of there being wars, etc. Because where the aggression really manifests itself is in the conditioning that people are brought up in. They're not brought up. I don't believe that they're brought up with or have the idea of aggression born into them. It eventually comes built into them through the education, the capitalist education, etc., that we get, the nationalism, the patriotism. This is where aggression can manifest itself much more often, I think, and people having disagreements about one thing or another, whether it be football or whatever it may be. No, I don't believe that people are born anything aggressive. The very point you make, or had been made previously, about the aggression gene, then, you know, no doubt some people will say, well, yeah, maybe there is an aggression gene. Well, is there not then a gene that doesn't make us aggressive? You know, I think I look at this from the world in which we live. We're not at each other's throats all the time until it comes to such a point where the capitalist class are at loggerheads with each other about markets, about gold and mine and oils and minerals, etc. That's where aggression manifests itself. But we're not born with that. And it's patriotism and nationalism that manifests itself in aggression at times.
Okay, thanks, Freddie. You just made me think there, when you talked about the real world, that probably in common with most people, almost all my experience of being involved in violent encounters was in school, in that particularly peculiar and restricted space that we put our kids in. Most people don't really have any experience of it beyond that. Okay, next up, John Cumming.
Yes, I think just further to the point that was just made, people are so aggressive that in the event of war, they have to be conscripted into the armed forces. And there was a criminal called Jimmy Boyle. I don't know if most of you have heard of him, but they were writing about him in the newspapers as to whether or not he had truly been rehabilitated. But that's not really that important. What they said about him was that he was somebody who would be very useful in the event of war, but an embarrassment in peacetime. And I think they were just making a point about war, how war brutalised people and so on. But I think, you know, this notion that we're innately aggressive is just not true. We're certainly capable of a great deal of aggression. I think it was Joseph Conrad who said, in relation to superstitious belief, that there's no need to resort to the supernatural. Man alone is capable of every evil. Now, he emphasised that because that was the nature of his sort of writing, but you can just emphasise all the other capabilities that human beings have. So we're capable of aggression as and when it's needed, but the government, for example, doesn't want, you would think they would want these people, such as I mentioned, like Jimmy Boyle, who was considered to be a psychopath, but they don't want that. What they want is nice, placid boys who can be moulded into obeying orders and then be trained into killing on command, just as they do everything else on command. So humans are very, very malleable. I think that's the lesson that we learn from history.
Okay, thanks, John. Richard?
Yeah, I mean, John has largely said what I was going to say. I think it's really important. I mean, when you're discussing with people, for me, people will come up with this idea that it's human nature. People are aggressive because it's part of human nature. And it's this concept of human nature that really needs interrogating, because it's a very confused idea. And basically what most people seem to mean when you try and pin them down to it is the idea that somehow there is this urge inside us that we are incapable of controlling, that comes out exploding like a volcano given certain situations, you know, that it's not actually within a human being's control. Yet, of course, as John has actually said, we know that's absolutely not true. You know, we know psychologically, for most people, not for everyone, but for the vast majority of people, it is exceedingly difficult to actually kill another person. That there are, in fact, psychological barriers. You have to actually have a certain degree of pressure on them over a period of time in order to make them do that for most people. So it's not that we can't kill people. We certainly, as John was saying, we have the capacity to kill. We have the capacity to love. We have the capacity for all sorts of things. But the question is whether it is necessarily something that we will and must and always will do as some form of behavior. And I think that's really the issue. You know, because, you know, there is a huge department. There is a whole discipline in psychology of training soldiers to be killers. It's now used very, very sophisticated techniques in order to get soldiers to kill, because naturally they're against it. There's a whole history of soldiers not being willing to kill in battle, and the efforts of armies to try and get them to overcome that. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. While you were saying that, Richard, by lateral thinking process, I was thinking back to a story that's been in the news the last few days that you must have, people here must have seen, the execution of the woman Lisa Montgomery in Indiana. On the orders, well, indirect orders of Donald Trump, you know, to live his last days in, you know, sort of bloodlust and infamy. She committed a quite hideous crime of murder, in quite hideous circumstances. But when you looked at the story of what had happened to this woman in her life, it was heartrending to see what she'd been through her entire life. And It just gives you an indication, I think, of the sort of things that you have to put the people through in order to make them do really desperate and murderous things. Slightly depressing thought. Well, time's moving on. Do we want to just give one more, have one more question? Should we just have one more question and then call it a day? We've certainly got enough.
I think we call it a day now, Paddy.
You want to call it a day now? Okay.
Well, myself, yes, but I mean, it's up to the rest of you. You know, yeah. I'm in favour of calling it a day. It's 20 past nine now. You know.
Okay, that's fair enough. All right then. Well, we'll.
And on that, you know, the questions is left. It keeps it quite uniform for the future.
Okay then. All right. Well, we'll stop there, and we'll carry on with the questions next FAQ session.
Thanks, Paddy.
Is that next week?
No, it'll be next month.
Next month, huh?
Yeah.